thumbs up when it's good. Alright. Every camera's recording?
Yep. No, except for my personal.
Awesome. What's going on, guys? Naeem Alobaidi here. I am honored to have Mr. Jeremy Gardner on live with us here at my penthouse in Hollywood, California. Jeremy, I'm super honored to have you here, man. If you guys don't know about Jeremy Gardner, he actually built one of the first decentralized applications on the Ethereum blockchain. It's a billion-dollar company. You may have heard of it. It's called Augur. And alongside with that, he's got a lot of other philanthropic things that he does, including the Blockchain Education Network, which is, I mean, how many colleges are supporting that? Over 100, for sure.
Yeah, I think we have 200 schools at this date, with active students at this point.
Absolutely. So we're going to just dive into this live Q&A, take some questions from the live audience, as well as go into some really important things that I think we should address right now with the world economy and where it's at right now. I mean, if you look at currencies, they're at all-time lows. Gold right now just broke an all-time high since 2014, and it's literally mimicking what Bitcoin is doing right now. And then alongside with that, Ray Dalio, who owns the largest hedge fund in the world, in his book Principles says every 10 to 12 years there's a market cycle and a recession. The last one was in 2008, and now we're 11 years in, and so it's that time for a market recession. And for the first time ever, Bitcoin is an asset class. And I know that's made you millions of dollars, and it's really created this huge platform for you, Jeremy. So we're super excited to dive into this interview. And first and foremost, I want to talk about the infamous Crypto Castle.
Sure.
So I know everyone's heard of the Crypto Castle. Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, what is the Crypto Castle?
Sure. So the Crypto Castle's infamy is not exactly well deserved. More and more so recently, but it started when the team that would become Augur moved up to San Francisco. We had our housing situation fall through at the last minute, and we moved into this dingy two-bedroom basement apartment in the outskirts of SF. And we had six people living there, and I jokingly called it the Bitcoin basement, because it was a basement apartment. It was grimy. It was not great. Eventually, we raised a little bit of money, and we ended up finding this place in the Potrero Hill neighborhood overlooking all of San Francisco. It was still just a three-bedroom house, but I jokingly called it the Crypto Castle. And I added it to Google Maps, created a Facebook page, but it wasn't serious. But then one day, Vitalik Buterin, the creator of Ethereum, was crashing on the couch, and a journalist from some publication that never took off, but had some readership, came to interview him about Ethereum. This is before Ethereum even launched. And she's asking him about Ethereum, clearly kind of a loss, not really following what she's saying. And then asking about this house that she's in, and then she ends up interviewing me. And then she decides, she's like, you know what? It's probably going to be a lot easier for me to just write in about this house full of crypto enthusiasts. And so it earned some fame as a result of that piece. And then dozens of journalists ever since, being tasked with explaining crypto, would take the shortcut and just come and write a story about my house because it always got clicks. And to your average reader, a house full of technology enthusiasts is a lot more relatable than trying to understand a technology than by it written about in an article by a journalist that doesn't really know how to explain it. So, so that kind of built up its reputation. And back in 2014, when we got the house, there was really no center points for crypto in San Francisco. So lots of people would come over after meetups. I'd host blockchain barbecues, but it wasn't that crazy. I would have an occasional party.
Were there any companies founded?
Yeah, so Augur was pretty much founded there. Then we had Comma AI, founded by George Hotz, otherwise known as GeoHot, the self-driving car startup. We had multiple funds launched there. I mean, it was crazy.
It contributed a lot to the sphere.
Yeah, by late 2017, we had over a half dozen residents had become millionaires as a result of living the house or in their time in the house, which was just nuts because we'd only had the house for 2 or 3 years at that point. And it's just it's an incredible place where interesting people get together. Lots of core developers from different projects, lots of entrepreneurs are just staying in town, come and crash at the place. It's a house. It's not this crazy party mansion. But then I started thinking, after over 5 years in San Francisco that maybe that wasn't the place I really wanted to live full time, and I wanted to travel less. And so I started thinking about places I didn't want to live. And it, my co-founder of my venture fund, Barbara, she was like, look, go stay at my condo in Miami, see if you like it down there. I think that may be the right place for you to go and like spend some of your time. I went down there, really just fell in love after initially hating Miami. And then what happened was, I think I was just like looking at condos. I was like, you know what, maybe I can do that. A crypto castle here. No, Bitcoin was down. It was about like 3,500. It was at pretty much all time lows. It's like, you know, I know some like wealthy crypto guys. Maybe I can get them to throw down on like an actual castle. I mean, Miami's full of mansions. Found this great place in the heart of Miami Beach on the water. And that is, it's kind of like this weird self-fulfilling prophecy. Very much lives up to the notoriety of the original crypto castle. But the first one's really disappointing because, firstly, it's nothing like a castle. Secondly, it's not that crazy. But the Miami castle is quite glorious.
Now it's turning into a brand. You have your own Instagram for the crypto castle.
Yeah,
I'm
starting a YouTube series, and what we decided to call was the Crypto Castle Chronicles. Had like a film crew follow me around for 2 weeks. Shot 77 scenes in like 15 days. It's about to go live on YouTube, like 12 10-minute episodes, then accompanied by like full-length interviews. I'm going to do what you do. I'm going to see if I can do it. I don't know if I have the patience or interest to do it, but I'm going to try it out. I think what's happening at the castle down in Miami, but as well as in San Francisco where we shot a couple episodes, is, you know, just the coming together of all these brilliant people leads for really fascinating conversations. And what I found by working with journalists and letting them report about me and reporting about the crypto castles is that they show one side of the story. But there's so much nuance to what we've created in these homes and what it means to actually be an entrepreneur. And that's something that I want to try to show because I don't feel like it's represented that well on the internet today. I feel like there's a lot of hustle porn that says just work, 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 read tons of books, don't ever enjoy yourself, blah, blah, blah. And then there's the crazy Dan Bilzerian bullshit, which is just all a total facade as well. And there has to be a middle ground between, you know, having a work-life balance. Like entrepreneurship, as an entrepreneur, it's more important to have a work-life balance than it is in almost any other profession. Because being an entrepreneur is so intense and it's so all-consuming, you need to find positive, enjoyable outlets. And I don't think enough of the people talking about this online, which is where a lot of people consume their information today, especially YouTube, I don't think that's really conveyed well.
Yeah, I see on your Instagram you've talked about mental health in the past.
No, that's a big thing.
Talked about a lot of things. And not only that, I also saw that, you know, not only is the Crypto Castle brand you're trying to build, but you're trying to bridge.
Well, it's a brand that I decided to own. You know? I started seeing the name being used, and I had to go trademark it because I was like, oh. Like, I don't want this being misappropriated, like, for just nefarious purposes. I don't like intellectual property, but I just felt like in order to make sure that the integrity of the brand wasn't totally ruined, or else I'd have to stop calling my houses that. But, you know, I'm running with it for now. It started as a joke. It's still kind of as a joke, but I kind of have a castle now, so maybe it's not a joke, and I don't realize it, but it's all, you know. Very cool.
So with all this amazing success and accomplishments, and obviously I know you're so humble as well, knowing that you have so much more to accomplish, I do want to talk about, you know, the early start in 2014, because most of this started because of the Blockchain Education Network that you eventually started from being a part of a Bitcoin club at your university, right?
Yeah.
And so I definitely want to talk about that because I saw that your executive director is actually from the MIT Bitcoin Club.
Yeah,
MIT is, you know, I don't think people really realize that these large colleges like Stanford and Harvard and MIT, actually have blockchain or even Bitcoin covered within their campuses, but you have a huge part in doing that right now with the Blockchain Education Network. Can you kind of like rewind early on how that got started and what that's turned into and what that's going to turn into?
Yeah, so I was familiar with Bitcoin before I transferred to the University of Michigan in 2014, had speculated on it, knew about the Silk Road, but didn't really take it particularly seriously as a technology, and just happened to move in with into an apartment with this young man who had dropped out of Michigan a year prior to start one of the very first Bitcoin
18-year-old computer scientists?
No, we'll get to that. Okay. But this young man, Kennard, was sleeping on our couch because he had like gone to start one of the first Bitcoin exchanges. It had been compromised, and he was still a diehard Bitcoin aficionado. And he convinced me to learn about the technology and join the University of Michigan Bitcoin Club. And at the very first Bitcoin Club meetup, I learned that there were Bitcoin clubs at MIT and Stanford. That same night, got on a call to head to those clubs. They talked about the respective successes and failures, all the club heads, and then the college suggested, why don't we create an organization out of this? And MIT and Stanford guys were like, sure, go ahead. And so we started going on Facebook, on Bitcoin Talk, on all the different forums for Bitcoin enthusiasts, and said, hey, if you're a college student, want to start a Bitcoin club or have one, let us know. Let's bring everyone together. And it was first called the College Cryptocurrency Network, now called the Blockchain Education Network. But within 3 months, we had over 100 chapters in 20 plus countries on every habitable continent. And
wow.
So I started getting asked to speak at conferences. We got this great feature, an entrepreneur. And through the nonprofit, I met Joey Krug, who is this 18-year-old computer scientist from Pomona, who I would go on to found Augur with. And so that's kind of how Augur was birthed, along with a crazy story.
And we can definitely get into Augur, do you want to give a little brief summary of what Augur is? You know, that is the actual blockchain company that he founded. It was one of the first...
Amongst
the
few, we haven't gone through the full resume, and we don't have to. But Augur is one of the best use cases I've come across to this day for decentralized applications. It's a decentralized prediction market platform. And a prediction market effectively is like a stock market, but instead of buying and selling shares based off of what you believe the future value of a company will be, you buy and sell shares based off of the future outcome of an event. Will Donald Trump be impeached, yes or no? Depending on how many shares are being bought of each side, you get a price. More people think it will be impeached, 60 cents for a yes share, correspondingly 40 cents for a no share. And what you get from that price is the probability that the market assigns of an event occurring. It's called the wisdom of crowds. So if you know more people are buying yes shares and it's 60 cents for a share of him saying that he'll be impeached, that means the market assigns a 60% probability of Donald Trump being impeached. And that's actually one of the best ways humanity has of predicting the future. That's why I got really excited about this tech, because it's this incredible forecasting tool, but because it kind of resembles gambling or betting, and because it competes with stock markets, derivatives, futures markets, they haven't been allowed.
It's decentralized, it's uncontrolled.
And totally censorship resistant.
And that can go any direction.
Yeah, but what's really exciting about Augur is that it literally allows you to create a financial market for anything. It at its very essence, is DeFi, this popular term today, decentralized finance. You can create a financial market, whether it's a derivative, whether it's a futures contract, whether it's recreating the stock market, doesn't matter, options, it can be so incredibly powerful. I think Ethereum needs to scale. Augur version 2.0, which is about to come out soon, will have stable coins, which makes long-term betting better. But it's a really exciting platform, hands down, and far and away one of my favorite blockchain applications to this day.
So we actually have a trading group, and most of my followers are traders, and so I don't want to dive into this too much because I know your opinion on trading. I know you're not an active trader.
Yeah.
But I do want to at least touch on it just for the people that are watching live. And I see we have a ton of people on live right now. We've got questions already ready. And we will be taking your questions. I see we got Hourglass, Dichara, Deferdo online right now. But, you know, in terms of trading, I mean, I've sent out trade calls for REP already, you know, like, so I know you're probably not actively trading it. But, you know, for me, I like the trading side of cryptocurrencies. I feel like that's the one place that anybody could find their place in crypto versus them trying to find, okay, how could I apply myself to this new industry as a developer, a software? Like, some people are not in that.
I mean, it is the one thing you can absolutely do in your spare time and maybe make money if you're smart about it. Yeah.
Yes. So, I know this is also a sensitive topic, so we probably shouldn't spend.
I'm not giving the investment advice.
Yeah,
you,
you
can ask me any question. But I will. I know what to dislike.
That's in our disclaimer. But I guess to ask a thought-provoking question that actually matters. You know, when it comes to, you know, these cryptocurrencies, where do you feel like the real intrinsic value comes from when it comes to having a coin or having a security token or having a utility token or having whatever?
I don't want to go on a huge rant, but you see, when we decided to build Augur, we first wanted to build it on top of Bitcoin. And that, if you read the original Augur white paper that was published back in fall 2014, we wrote how to build a decentralized prediction market platform on top of Bitcoin. And turns out Bitcoin's not very good for building decentralized applications. But more importantly, what we soon realized as we thought about the incentives behind this sort of system was that if we wanted to create decentralized consensus or a decentralized oracle to say whether or not an event occurred, we needed a token. Because what we came across is a problem that has plagued computer science since the dawn of the internet, is how do you get there to be a source of truth that does not come from one central point of failure. Mm-hmm. And what we realized was that by creating what we called an app token at the time, a token for Augur, not used for betting, but for reporting on the outcome of events that thousands of people own, we could create a decentralized source of truth, solving this age-old computer science problem. And it was incredibly novel. We didn't want to issue a token. We didn't want to do what I called like a crowd sale, but now more fondly known as an ICO. It scared the shit out of us. Like, that was not the approach we wanted to take, but we realized there was no way to achieve a bona fide decentralized prediction market platform without having this secondary token. And that was the first utility token ever created. It was the first ERC 20 ICO on top of Ethereum, but more importantly, the first real utility token ever created.
Wow.
And I didn't think there would be that many utility tokens after that. You know, I thought it was a really great use case, and to this day, I actually think it's the best utility token out there. But I didn't see that many good applications of a token that didn't secure a blockchain. And for about a year, we didn't really see that many more. And then in late 2016, everything changed. You know, some savvy entrepreneurs realized, hey, what if I just add blockchain to what I'm doing and create my own cryptocurrency and like use it for payments or some other like asinine reason? And then they started being able to raise huge amounts of money. And I was up in arms because, you know, I held utility tokens to such a high standard because we had created this one that actually was game theoretically necessary to make our application work, and nothing I saw afterwards really did that. Now, there are a handful of exceptions. There are a few utility tokens I think are sensible and could work if the application works out. But keep in mind, there's a ton of compounded risk when you're betting on a token economics built on top of an application that people may never use, built on top of a blockchain that may not work out. So it's a very risky proposition, but there are a handful of good utility token use cases. But if I had to, if I had to augur, I would tell you that I don't think there are going to be more than 100 utility tokens in the future. And for that matter, I don't think there are going to be more than 6 to 12 blockchains. And I'm increasingly convinced there are going to be even less than 12, closer to 6.
I love it. So amazing. You know, that was some awesome explanation. Let's kind of like switch sides to this. I know you have your hybrid venture hedge fund,
mm-hmm.
and some people know what hedge funds are, but if you want to talk a little bit about your hybrid venture hedge fund, what that means specifically, as well as what you guys are accomplishing, I think that would be a good topic.
So back in late 2017, in the midst of all this ICO madness I was just talking about, you know, I was very alarmed very early on, like beginning of 2017. I was like, what the hell is going on? This is not good. Like, this is like, I really hated the ICO boom of 2017, early 2018. But I had invested literally every penny I had. I had been paid for every job I did. I took rent from the other kids in my house in crypto and then paid with my credit card for my rent. So literally everything I owned was in crypto. And you know, in the summer of 2016, when Augur's token got listed, you know, all of a sudden, pretty much overnight, I was wealthy, I was a millionaire. But because I had taken all my wealth and put it into crypto over the past 4 years, when the ICO boom happened in 2017, I became quite wealthy. I mean, like, I was just like, I never cared about being rich. I never cared really about making money. I just wanted to have fun and make the world a better place. And all of a sudden, I was like, you know, worth a lot of money. And I was like, not feeling good.
You did so much for the industry.
I didn't feel sustainable. And I was agreeing to do articles, and almost in a matter of a month, I had like 3 articles came out about me that pretty much made me the poster child for crypto's nouveau rich in the fall of 2017. And I just had this massive amount of cognitive dissonance because I was like, first of all, I've never talked to any of these journalists about how wealthy I am. They've just kind of extrapolated that and figured it out. I'm still living exactly the same way I've been living for the past 4 years. But they were just making me out as this like rich kind of playboy type, and I didn't really love it. And moreover, I didn't think what was happening in the market was sustainable, yet more and more people were buying crypto because they were reading about my story. And I spent the past 4 years evangelizing crypto and blockchain technology as this way to make the world better. And yet, at that point, and even today to a certain extent, it happened. And so I was rich. People were trying to emulate me for all the wrong reasons. And the reasons that I was passionate about this industry hadn't even been realized. And so I realized I felt ethically obliged not to sell my crypto. Despite in January 2018 at the Miami Bitcoin conference, I called the top. I said, this market's going to go down
80 or 90%.
Got misquoted the New York Times, but I told the journalist there, I was like, I think the market's going to go down 90%. But I said this multiple times, but I knew that if I sold, I'd be selling into people that were, you know, not as attuned to the market as I was. And I felt bad about that because I felt like that could have been someone that read about me and decided to buy crypto. And so what I decided to do instead was, I was looking at the investments we were making at Blockchain Capital. I'm an investor in Polychain Capital, Olaf's hedge fund. And what I realized was that the investments that the hedge fund was making, that we were making at Blockchain Capital, even those deals, like while they were much higher quality than most of the ICOs at the time, they actually didn't align with my belief that this technology was going to make the world better as much as I wanted it to. And I met this brilliant young woman, Barbara Manuzzi, who was the first Latina to launch a venture fund in Silicon Valley. And she had been encouraging me to consider launching my own fund. And you know, I was like, all right, I guess I'll do it. Let's take the money I made. But what we're going to do is it's not just going to be a crypto fund. It's certainly not going to be a hedge fund because I don't do this for the money. I do this because I believe the technology is going to change the world. And I said, we're going to create the first social impact-oriented blockchain technology fund. And I realized there would have to be a hedge fund component because unlike a fund like Blockchain Capital, which was limited, or even Andreessen Horowitz before they changed their fund structure, those funds were so limited in the crypto assets they could hold. Most of their limited partner agreements wouldn't let them do that. And so I was like, no, I need to hold crypto, but it's going to be long term. We're not going to sell. And you know, what I did in the winter of 2017, 2018, I told my potential investors, I was like, look, the market's going to go down, it's going to crash, it's going to hurt. But you know, we have long term conviction in the assets that we're holding, going to hold, and the companies that we're going to invest in, and it won't matter. You know, I've been through one of these bear markets before.
Me too.
And you know, I kind of wanted to eat my foot for the past year and a half as we suffered through the bear market. The fund was down. Like, it didn't feel great, but, you know, I had conviction in the assets that we held and have incredible conviction in the startups that we've invested in since. And we have some amazing investors, some rockstar LPs, but it's a small fund. You know, I think we started with just under 15 mil. Because fortunately, we started the fund after the market had already begun to tank. Like, it was at the top of the dead cat bounce. But, you know, we've been fine. And fortunately, because I told all my investors that the market was going to perform poorly, you know, none of them are mad at me for the fund's performance. And we've got some really great portfolio companies. So it's been a wild ride, you know. But more importantly, it's given this fund has given me this platform to talk about the social impact of blockchain technology. And not just look like I'm saying it to make blockchain technology look good. Like, I'm actually standing by that in the investments that we're making as an organization.
That is a perfect transition. So I think a lot of that was prefacing, you know, your experience so far in this industry to gain the credibility of you guys. And by the way, for those of you live, if you want to ask questions right now, post it in the live chat, because his time is valuable. And so as soon as we're done with this next session, you know, in about 5 or 10 minutes, we'll start taking those live questions so we can wrap this up. But I want to start transitioning to the why behind everything, because I know you're really big on autonomy, financial sovereignty, and access to truth. But beyond that, you were also working under the current Attorney General of Massachusetts, who was previously the governor.
That was like a 2 week stint. I like to talk about it because it was such a formative experience. You know,
why did you think politics was for you?
So let's get that. So I think I've always had this kind of messiah-like complex. Like, I've always wanted to make the world better at scale. But as a young kid, I had no direction. I grew up in a small town in Western Massachusetts. There are no entrepreneurs. There were like the only I had American history to look at who the great people were. I had the history books. And so I always knew I wanted to do meaningful, important things. My greatest inspirations were like Martin Luther King, Gandhi, Ben Franklin. Those are like, and then Barack Obama later on. And I knew I wanted to do something important in the world, but I was a total delinquent. I got kicked out of school, arrested.
Me too, I got expelled.
Arrested many times. Like, I was, I set the bar very low for myself. Nobody really had high expectations for me. But after a lot of this kind of delinquency began to subside, right when I got into college, the Occupy Wall Street movement broke out. And I had been really taken aback by the level of criminality committed by the banks in 08 and the years preceding it. And so I was down in Zuccotti Park and I was protesting, but we never made demands. This was a big argument at Occupy. And, you know, despite spawning a global movement in cities across the world, it achieved nothing. It paved a platform for folks like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, but it really didn't accomplish anything. And if you look at Dodd-Frank, you know, all it did was kill small banks and make stifling regulation for fintech startups. Like, it wasn't really, really nothing that happened in the wake of, you know, the financial regulations and the Occupy movement were things to really pat yourself on the back for. And so I was like, screw it, I think we really, like, if I want to make a difference, I should probably go to politics. And I had already thought about developing my own major, and I developed my own major in political strategy, which was this really fun combination of political studies, social psychology, microeconomics, mostly game theory, and then military strategy, which was the perfect major for going into this industry later on. But even fun side note, I was actually one of the first non-cadets to study at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. So that was near my first college. Anyhow, I ended up working for the governor of Massachusetts over the summer before my junior year. Then, right before my junior year, I had this crazy, stupid incident. End up dropping out of the school on that. And then get a job working for the woman who's now Attorney General of Massachusetts. And those two jobs, while very insightful, were insightful for all the wrong reasons. Working for the governor, I learned how inefficient the bureaucracy in a very well-run state government, like
welcome to DMV, and that's how our government runs. Right?
Yeah, I mean, DMV is bad, but actually no. That this was work. I primarily worked at the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination, which was an incredibly illustrative experience. for lots of reasons. Made me very aware of kind of my privilege in the world. But more importantly, they had a 4-year backlog and discrimination complaints. I helped them by moving around some of their files, like cut down their backlog by a quarter. I mean, it was amazing. But
wow.
No, you just don't have anyone smart working in these bureaucracies, for the most part. Excuse me if you do. But really, like, it, the government is so inefficient on so many levels. And I think this would start to push me away from the extreme liberalism and progressivism I kind of grew up with in the town I lived in and the parents I had. But then I worked for this woman running for attorney general, and this is not a huge state race. It's a year before the election, and the only conversation we had about for 2 weeks after I started was raising money.
Mm.
And I was like, wow, if a small state race like this, which has huge like campaign finance limits, like some of the strictest in the country, is so oriented around raising money, I'm only going to spend my 20s pushing paper and raising money for politicians. So I quickly got out of that. And that's actually part of what inspired me to go back to school, which was very serendipitous, because then I would fall into the wild world of Bitcoin.
I love that, man. That is amazing. So we are going to take some questions here from the live audience. So let's see. One question that we have here is, if you think this market bubble is separate from traditional markets, you're wrong. People will need fiat to pay bills during a recession. What is your thoughts on that?
Well,
that's an interesting question.
It's a loaded question. First of all, there are services that allow you to pay your taxes and pay your bills in crypto. I'm not going to name them all. I think BitPay just partnered with the state of Ohio, so you can actually pay your state taxes via crypto. But there are all sorts of services that allow that. But secondly, like, I don't know if this was an attack on something I said, because I can't think of anything I said.
Yeah, I don't think you mentioned
anything that's related to that. But I will say that I don't believe that crypto today is a suitable replacement for most use cases of the fiat money. I mean, price stability is the most important component of money. So unless you live in Zimbabwe or Venezuela, it's not a very interesting form of money today. Now, what Libra's doing, I can go on about Libra, but I've been doing talk about Libra in too many interviews recently, and they haven't given me a note yet. So we're not going to go into Libra. But I think what Facebook's doing could actually change the whole paradigm for how we think about digital currency. And I think a lot of countries are going to
issue
that.
It'll turn into like WeChat.
Yeah.
It's
but look, the discussion about crypto as a replacement for fiat is not sensible in the developed world for the most part. It just doesn't have that much utility unless you're like doing black market things. But as a store of value, as a tool for applications, as a fuel for different decentralized services, it can be very interesting. But yeah, if you want to go pay your bills or pay your taxes or pay rent, you know, more likely than not, you're going to be using government-issued money, and you know, that's totally okay. You know, Rome wasn't built in a day, and neither is literally a brand new paradigm for a decentralized world. It just doesn't happen overnight, and in fact, I think it would be a bad thing if all of a sudden all the fiat currencies of the world disappeared. I think it would be a nightmare.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I'm always preaching Bitcoin as the storage of value that it is, because people, they call it a currency, but it's not. It's too efficient to be a currency, inefficient to be a currency.
Hey,
but,
you know, like, look, Bitcoin's 10 years old. If you look at the history of money, it's you can't even chart that in relation to most other forms of money. I mean, I guess if you look at the non-gold standard form of money, kind of, you could chart it, but like, it is something that could be money in the future that will continue to gain more utility as things like the Lightning Network are developed. But fundamentally, you know, we are not going to get mass adoption of Bitcoin in the next 10 years as a form of digital cash. We're just not. Unless nation states started totally banning cash, and you started to crack down on all sorts of like financial activity. It's not a reasonable expectation today. But things like Libra are going to create this incredible Trojan horse for people becoming familiar with digital wallets, digital currency, and making people much more inclined towards the use of something like Bitcoin. especially as, you know, I think the financial panopticon, excuse me, it will grow, and, you know, countries will start to wean off cash, and there will be more scrutiny by, you know, tax revenue services around the world of people's financial behavior. People are going to want financial privacy, mm-hmm. and that may be realized through Bitcoin, although that's a big debate to be had whether Bitcoin will ever implement the necessary privacy tools, or whether that will go to another privacy-oriented coin. But, you know, the move to crypto as a replacement for cash is going to be gradual.
Absolutely, and it's just, yep, you're right, it's a storage of value.
Yeah, and that's the use case I try to sell people on. When people are like, oh, is it a cryptocurrency? I'm like, yeah, it can be. I pay people for things with Bitcoin. Like, that's not... I receive people's rent in Bitcoin. Like, I'm happy. I always love to receive Bitcoin as currency. I just never like to send it as currency. It's an accumulation game.
It's all about holding. So I guess we'll take another question here from Hourglass. Do you think the U.S. economy is going to experience a huge downturn anytime soon, or will the U.S. prop up the market like it has in the past, prolonging the crash and possibly making it worse?
That's a great question. on so many levels. Yeah. You know, we've just, I think, you know, the U.S. economy in many regards has been propped up by this policy of quantitative easing, which we have no real precedent for in discerning whether it's sustainable. And with interest rates not really rising, you know, any sort of real downturn, any sort of black swan event in the economy, it's not going to be easy to prop it back up. And so I think there really could be, like, I mean, the longer the times are good, most likely the longer the times will be bad. We have precedent for that in the Roaring Twenties and the Great Depression that happened afterwards. But, you know, more importantly, you know, I'll take this on a tangent. I think the biggest black swan event, and nobody really talks about in crypto, is what happens if there is a sudden recession or even depression in the U.S. economy, and therefore the global economy. Mm. I think this would be really bad for crypto. I don't think, because you're talking about, Bitcoin being this asset class, it may be an asset class, but similar to gold's place in the world today, just like we saw in 2008, gold went down worse than the overall market. Yet, and I think we'll see this should there be a similar sort of event in the near future, gold was the first to recover, and it recovered the fastest and the strongest. And I think crypto assets will do the exact same thing in the wake of that sort of black swan event. But crypto assets are definitely going down.
So it does its job as acting as a hedge, which is what.
Well, no. So if you want to hedge against the global economy, hold U.S. dollars. If you think the economy is going to go into a downturn, there are a few other assets that are safer than the dollar, because even when the U.S. economy goes down first, the rest of the global economy goes down faster, and that's why we have such a strong dollar today, is because, you know, we recovered first, and, you know, our money is sound.
I love it, man. I didn't know you had that much insight on this.
I don't know what the hell I'm talking about when it comes to the macro economy, but I develop these theses in my head, and sometimes they play out.
So I guess we'll wrap this up because it did go a little bit long.
I've got time.
I do got three quick questions that that we got submitted earlier through our group.
Yeah.
One question here: what should people learn about blockchain technology?
I mean, that's a bold question. So I've tried to answer that in multiple ways in my career, you know, starting with the Blockchain Education Network.
Oh, sorry, why should people learn? Sorry, there you go. Because the what doesn't matter, the why matters.
Yeah.
I just misread that.
Look, the world, in the globalized world that we live in.
I was like, I did not pick a bad question. What's going on here? The vibe changed real quick.
In the globalized world that we live in, there is massive business, whether it's in government, whether it's in trade finance or supply chains or agriculture or energy or just traditional finance, it doesn't matter. Businesses have just exploded in scale, in breadth, and global reach. And what that has enabled, now this has always existed throughout the course of human history, but exponentially more so in the past 200 years, is the growth of middlemen that provide services in between businesses and in between consumers and businesses and individuals by governments. And there's just lots of middlemen, but it doesn't matter what the industry is. And for the most part, a lot of those middlemen are really rent seekers. And the reason why they seek rent is because there's a lack of trust in the system. And what they can do is say, hey, we'll create the trust between these one or two entities. And so what happens is that for the people creating value or content in the world, a lot of that value that they're creating or content is being deprived by these middlemen. And thus consumers get less and they pay more. And what blockchain technology affords is this brilliant paradigm for the trustless global exchange of value without the need for an intermediary. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter whether you're like an independent music artist or someone that needs a document notarized. For the first time, I mean, notarization was kind of possible before, but let's say you want to settle a trade. Like, for the first time, you don't need middlemen. Blockchains allow for this kind of very accountable, auditable system that's totally immutable, in which the exchange of value can happen frictionlessly. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, lots of businesses that rely on just taking a cut out of a transaction in order to provide trust are no longer needed. And that's brilliant. It creates a more dynamic global economy, allows trade and exchange of goods to happen much faster and much more trustlessly, and it allows for the value creators to receive more for the value they're creating, and for the value consumers to ideally get a better deal on what they're consuming. And so the applications are absolutely endless, and where this technology will be most effective in disintermediating middlemen is still to be determined. But the ramifications are close to, if not equal to, or even greater than what the internet did for the global economy. I'm fairly certain of that. I mean, if you look what Facebook's doing, I mean, they're effectively, if they pull this off, they're pulling off the biggest business coup in human history, and going from this massive social network to, well, they're creating the world's biggest central bank. They're becoming the world's, they're taking their social network and becoming the world's largest financial services company.
And so, they're very closely tied to the U.S. government.
Yeah, lots of thoughts there. But really, blockchain technology has the potential to, I'm not saying it will, but to fundamentally disrupt any business that involves the exchange of value. And that's every business. And so,
it'd be interesting to see in the future if people are going to trust these bigger companies and using their coins, or if
I don't think payment coins are really going to exist. Like, what Facebook is creating is unique to what Facebook has, which is the largest user base of humans of any organization or government in history. And so they have this mass of people that can have their life enhanced by the use of a digital currency. And no other business has that.
No, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
People say, oh, Amazon and Apple and Google are going to do this.
Not
they don't have they don't have the users. They don't have the people that have this need. They don't have the people that are using their platforms for the sake of communication and exchange of information with one another. And so Facebook is that tool. And so Facebook is uniquely positioned to create this kind of global digital currency. And it can really be this tremendous force for good. But people saying that, like, all these other, FANG and Fortune 100 companies are going to create cryptocurrencies, it's the same reason why altcoins used for payments are really fucking dumb. It's like, we don't need that many payment systems, but we do need one, and Facebook is hands down the best organization in human history to create it.
I love that, man. I think that's going to be a very, very interesting topic to look back on when we see what happens with the Facebook Libra.
I've been very good in my bets. First, betting big on Bitcoin early in my career, then betting big on Ethereum, and every time,
Vegas?
Everyone thought I was, I thought I was an idiot, and then, you know, then in Augur as well, and then I decided to start talking about Facebook, you know, when like David Marcus joined. A year and a half ago, I've been saying, you know, Facebook is the most important development in crypto right now. Everyone laughed at me. And then the Libra announcement came out. And I actually don't even think it's that contrarian to say how awesome Libra is or how exciting the development is. But, you know, for a long time, you know, everyone's like, why are you talking about Facebook's cryptocurrency? It's just going to be a stupid exercise. And I think people are starting to get it now, but I'm still going to look like a total idiot if it doesn't pan out or it gets shut down. But I think what Facebook is doing is hands down the most important development, if not in my entire time in this industry, at least since the introduction and launch of Ethereum. But I think it could be even more important.
That's deep. So here's a question that we got as well. Who are three CEOs or founders that you really see a future with?
Intimate relationship, or do I think their vision? You to decide. Now, are we talking about their vision for this industry and what they're going to accomplish, or their vision for their company and what the company
is
going to
accomplish? I think the industry is the most important part. You know, like for me, I would say Binance's CEO. You know, he's always been proactive, listening to people. You know, like he created the BNB feature where you could the coins, like when they're like too small a decimal, and then you just turn them all into BNB. Like those little things are innovative, but they're so impactful because it makes the whole experience of the, you know, at least in the trading side, more easily accessible, easily understood. So you know, I love Binance's CEO, but
yeah, I've known CEC for several years. I think he's a good one. I don't find myself being inspired by the way he thinks about this industry. He's like the most pro innovation. He's like, create your shit coins. I will sell them if it makes me money. And good for him. Like that's great. But like I actually think that hampers the industry in a very big way by allowing these really garbage tokens, some fraudulent, some securities to flourish. I think that actually holds this industry back. So
why Binance just got banned. So
I don't want to trash talk them because a lot of people love them. I think CZ is a brilliant entrepreneur. But if we're talking about their vision, I don't think I'm that aligned with them. I think I'm gonna cheat and talk about the people close to my heart. I mean Joey Krug, my co-founder of Augur. Now the co-chief investment officer of Pantera Capital, managing with one other person as a co-chief investment officer $500 million at age 23. I mean, this kid is one of the most brilliant, underappreciated minds in this industry. I am so fortunate to have met him. Our careers have been so intertwined in so many ways. I see him like a brother. I trust his judgment and so much, you know. He, hands down, he just gets this tech. He's what I call a blockchain native. I mean, he's been doing computers his whole life, but really everything he knows about economics, it comes from our experience in crypto, and so he's really bright. And then similar to that is Vitalik from Ethereum. Mm. Just, he gets it. He's open-minded, one of the smartest people I've ever met. Really just a pioneer, takes everything with such grace and maturity for someone, once again, so incredibly young, similar, you know, a year older than Joey. I think he's like 24, 25. Mm. And then who would I say is the third one? I mean, founders, vision, what companies do I really
I think two is enough.
Yeah, well, I guess one guy who I've always really admired is Eric Voorhees, CEO of Shapeshift. He was like a pretty hardcore maximalist. This guy, from an ideological or political perspective, you know, we have been arguing nonstop since we met 6 years ago. He's this like hardcore libertarian, but so respectful. He's so nuanced. He allows, similar to what Vitalik does, he really allows his views to evolve. He takes criticism well. He was a pretty big Bitcoin maximalist for the first couple of years I knew him, and really took a much more open-minded approach, obviously founded Shapeshift, which is for all sorts of crypto assets. Mm. But he constantly innovates, he constantly iterates, he constantly pushes the boundaries of regulatory compliance, and then, you know, always has to take a few steps back when his lawyers make him. But that guy is, like, as tried and true, like, bona fide Bitcoiner, blockchainer there
is.
Yes,
you are, too.
Yeah, but I...
got protesting, Occupy Wall Street.
But I was... I came from
you
a much
your
more...
Your first Bitcoin Club meeting.
I think I'm a novel sort of OG crypto guy in that, like, I was probably the first outspoken liberal or kind of progressive-minded individual in the industry from a political perspective. Most guys were, like, cypherpunks, crypto-anarchists, libertarians, and I was not, a few Republicans. And so I was arguing with everyone back then. But what I really always appreciated about Eric is that I really think he has an incredibly high level of integrity. He doesn't screw people over. He deals with so much shit from every single direction, and he just handles it with grace. And that's the sort of maturity I really look up to, you know? There are not that many mature people in this industry, and I really immensely respect him, even though I constantly disagree with him.
Yeah, it's crazy you say that. Anytime I'm looking for somebody new on my team, it's loyalty and integrity that I look for, because I believe I can teach anybody anything, but integrity and loyalty,
you can't teach that. I think you can teach loyalty.
Through example.
But, you know, if a person... You know, some people are disloyal through trauma, and like you can't, you have to teach them that, you know, loyalty can be something that's worth having. But often as an executive or a CEO, the amount of work it takes to build back the value that's required to be loyal is tough. But like, we live in like a disloyal era, like whether you're looking at professional sports,
yeah.
Or whether you look at like Silicon Valley and how engineers just hop around from one company to the next, like, you know, America wasn't built on a foundation of strong family principles, no matter what the Republicans tell you. It's always been about having independence and innovation and moving forward. And so that's not necessarily tied to loyalty. I think that's a much more of a communalist mentality that you see much more in East Asia and a lot more religious cultures. However, you do need to have the ability to grow into loyalty. Like, I'm not loyal to anyone until I really get to know them and I really value and cherish them. So the integrity part's much more important to me. But I think, you know, yeah, I would say I'd be careful about that, because loyalty is something that's earned. You know, you need to know that somebody is capable of becoming loyal rather than them being loyal immediately. You know, you don't want
history
slaves.
Typically repeats itself.
Yeah, you want independent thinkers, though. You want people that are, you know, if you're doing something wrong, you want them to be disloyal and call you out, and, you know, or if you're breaking the law, like, I want someone that if I wasn't listening to them and I was doing bad to the world and I just wasn't listening, you know, tell the FBI. I mean, I'm not worried about that, but, you know, loyalty is a slippery slope, as we see in the case of authoritarian countries and megalomaniacal CEOs.
I love it. I think that's good, man. What are we at on time?
We're like at the 55-minute mark.
Really? Awesome.
My day is going to be thrilled with that.
Yeah.
Oops.
Talking about loyalty.
All right, we're on that now.
So it seems like we don't have much more questions. Anything that you want to leave us with, Jeremy?
No. I mean, I'm always available on the internet to answer questions.
Where could we find you? Where's your main platform?
I mean, if you ask smart questions, I think Twitter's the best place. You know, don't DM me on Instagram unless, you know, you're responding to a story of mine that's relevant. But, like, I'm fairly available. I'm not overly available. I run way too many things right now to be focused on dealing with random strangers on the internet. But if someone asks me a thoughtful question, I'm available. You know, Gonzo Gardner on Instagram and now on YouTube. That series is coming out in the next couple of weeks. Disruptopreneur, just Jeremy Gardner on Twitter. And those are the best places to find me.
Awesome, Jeremy. Thank
or
you so much.
Or Tinder if you're a cute girl. Yeah.
There you go. Thank you for being on TPC Traders Profit Club, man. We appreciate you.
Thank you, man. Anytime.
Awesome. We can wrap this video up. That was some good stuff.
Yeah, we ran again.
You're like, damn, he did research me.
Yeah, well, the intro was bad. You didn't. Yeah.